Blog Talk Radio.
Importance for the committee to produce a plan that creates jobs and spurs growth
because the committee's proposals will come on top of a set of already dramatic spending cuts that will have adverse economic consequences.
Yeah, and there's a short graph here that says discretionary cuts, the cost, impact on GDP and jobs in 2012. The discretionary cuts are $30.5 billion, and the GDP impact will be a negative $43 billion, and job impact a negative 323,000 jobs. No payroll tax holiday. The cost is $118 billion, all right, and the GDP impact, $128 billion, all right, and job impact is 972,000 jobs, all right. That's the job impact. That's how many jobs will be lost. And no extended unemployment insurance.
I think this is cruel.
And then $45 billion is the cost, all right, and the GDP impact will be at $70 billion, and the job impact will be 528,000 jobs, and total job losses will be 1,822,000 jobs.
822,000 jobs.
Yeah, and then the total GDP impact will be a minus $241 billion. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
It's ridiculous.
And the actual cost will be $193 billion, but the cost for the impact will be on 241.
Obama has shown no leadership, none whatsoever.
No. Interesting article. This is Think Progress Economy, by the way, is the name of the blog. But debt ceiling deal will cost that. But after the proposed hike, Reagan increased debt ceiling twice as fast as Obama. Bonner said a lot of Republicans want to force default, create enough chaos to pass balanced budget amendment.
Hmm.
That was what was happening this week. I mean, so these bastards are out of their minds. And, let's see. Here's something. Study. Falling unionization is increasing income inequality.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to check this one out?
Sure.
Since we got Larry on tonight, Larry Dorman, the Ask Me Union.
He's talked about this. Deunionization is worsening the income inequity gap.
Inequality gap, yeah.
Counting for nearly a third and a fifth of wage inequality among men and women, respectively. According to a study by Bruce Weston of Harvard University, data proves the role of unions as an equalizing force in the labor market. From 1973 to 2007, wage inequality in the private sector increased by more than 40% among men and by about 50% among women. Deunionization, the decline in the percentage of the labor force that is unionized, and educational stratification explain about 33% of the rise within group wage inequality among men. Among women, deunionization explains about 20% of the increase in wage inequality, whereas education explains more than 40%. Part of the reason for this gender discrepancy is that men have experienced a much larger decline in private sector union membership, from 34% in 1973 to 8% in 2007. The women, who went from 16% to 6% during the same period. Even non-union workers benefit from stronger unions as employers raise wages and increase employee benefits. The study also attributes the changing normative perception of pay equity to the decline of unions, arguing that unions helped institutionalize norms of equity. Tellingly, the decreasing rate of unionization clearly parallels the squeeze on middle-class incomes, and they show a chart. Oh, yes.
That's pretty sad. You know, and then since the union movements began to stumble in the 70s, the link between workers and productivity and wages has severed, leading employees to work harder for less and less money. And
between
1980 and 2008, nationwide worker productivity grew by 75%, while workers' inflation-adjusted average wages increased by only 22.6%. Today, unionized workers make about $2.50 more per hour than their non-unionized national counterparts. But whereas unions may contribute to increased wages and benefits, a harsh legal environment and negative public perception are keeping unions rates low. And so that's what's happening there.
Yeah, there's a lot of publicity,
yeah.
A lot of stuff, anti-union stuff going around.
Yeah, and this thing with the FAA, I just don't understand it. I just don't understand
it. I don't either.
This shutdown. Maybe if Larry can shed some light on it, I probably doubt it because it just doesn't make sense to anybody. But this one here. With all eyes in Washington focused on the debt ceiling debate, little has been made about another costly impasse. Republicans have refused to reauthorize the Federal Aviation Administration without including an anti-union measure in the deal. And leaving the FAA in the midst of a costly 10-day shutdown that has forced it to furlough more than 4,000 workers nationwide. And now with congressional leaders seemingly close to the ending their fight, well, this has already happened. This happened yesterday, this article written, after it votes on the debt ceiling. Democrats in the House Transportation Committee are outraged, as Representative Nick Rahel, a Democrat from
West Virginia,
and Jerry Costello, a Democrat from Illinois, called the recess irresponsible and said they plan to write a letter to Cantor calling him to keep the House in session until FAA has reauthorized. Meanwhile, the FAA airports inspectors keep doing their jobs even without pay. Holy cow. And the administrators for the Federal Aviation Administration says airport safety inspectors nationwide are working without pay and shouldering travel expenses themselves as the agency budget crisis enters a second week. That's
ridiculous.
An inspector may travel to 5 airports in a 2-week period, racking up thousands of dollars in hotel and airline tickets. Babbitt says they're being asked to put those expenses on personal credit cards. Oh, my God. And the government is losing more than $200 million a week in revenue generating through ticket taxes during the shutdown and $2.5 billion in airport infrastructure improvement projects all on hold. The airlines, meanwhile, have used those tax breaks to line their own pockets rather than pass the savings on to customers. And the Senate is reportedly staying in session to work on the reauthorization plan. You know, this is just, you know,
this guy has been a complete idiot.
Yeah, Cantor's a complete asshole. But the thing that amazes me is
how carrying those people out.
Yeah,
they would.
But this is a problem because if they stopped that, and if everybody stopped that, all right, then it would force these sons of bitches to act. And all they're doing is it's a union busting measure.
Yeah.
You know, so why would some asshole want to pay out of his own pocket, all right, to do his job? All right, when there's no job, when he's not getting paid at all, that doesn't make any sense to me. And there's a problem here with the FAA inspectors. You got to be out of their minds as well. I mean, to be doing that. I mean, they could force a strike. They could force it right there.
Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, maybe this article isn't complete. We'll have to find out more
information. Well, it's complete in the sense that people are paying out of their own pockets.
Yeah, but we don't know all sides of it. So hopefully, maybe Larry can shed some light on this. Maybe he knows a little more about it.
Yeah, maybe. But who knows? Who the hell knows? And there's another one here. A forum for the Israeli lobby, neocons and the whirling Obama apologists. I love this. This is by Sybil Edmonds. This was on her boilingfrogspost.com. And Sybil Edmonds was the FBI reporter. Our FBI whistleblower. Who, during 9/11, who spilled the beans on how they how this whole thing was just how 9/11 was such a sham
and how they all knew about it and stonewalled.
And she was one of the only women. She was one of the only out of five people in the FBI who actually spoke Farsi, okay, in Arab. And they were translating these communiques,
right?
All right, and she realized that this was all bullshit. And when she realized that there was the Al Qaeda and all that crap was just bullshit, she blew the whistle, and she's been vilified ever since. But this is really interesting too, because now she's going after the anti-Semites, you know, supposedly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And Daily Cause, I don't know, for those of you who are liberals, if you go to the Daily Cause, please understand that Cause, okay, the Cause, Gazowski, I believe his name is, he's actually a CIA operative. He's worked for the CIA forever, right? He was recruited, and he was in the military. He was an intelligence officer, and then when he got out of the military, he started up the Daily Cause, which became a liberal, a blog, okay? And is considered one of the biggest liberal blogs in the country.
So you wonder how much is fed to him.
Well, all of this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and this is why it makes me laugh. A forum for the Israeli lobby, neocons, and the whirling Obama apologists.
A parasitic puppet forum. No list from 9/11 to Israel and Obama cons. I generally don't like to spend time and energy going after the little parasites at the bottom of the ailing disease chain that has infested our nation. Surely they pop up here and there as examples illustrating our royal diseases. For example, if I am writing about mega corporations, mega foundations implementing their mega infestation plans through parasitic little NGOs, then one or two little NGO parasites show up in my writing. The same exact principle applies to phony little entities who pose as alternatives. I usually don't give them status by covering and dwelling upon those parasites either. With that said, I'm making an exception with a post prompted by a recent example came upon yesterday. Daily Cause has acted to ban commenters from linking to Mondawise, charging me with anti-Semitism. It is a disgraceful smear and hides Daily Cause's real anxiety. It cannot deal with the issue of Palestinian human rights any more than the Democratic Party can, and so Israel's supporters are striking at me. And this from another writer over there at Mondawise. Several times over the last few months, I've been alerted by friends regarding diaries by members of Team Shalom at Daily Cause, highly critical of Mondawise. Why does this matter? For our side, I don't think it does. It's clear some of our biggest detractors read this site avidly, including the comments that ultimately drive traffic. Team Shalom has run a campaign to have this site banned from Daily Cause, even though I am not aware posters there link to this site with any regularity. Perhaps I am wrong. And yesterday, one of my friends who posts there wrote to inform me they have achieved this goal.
You can read more about other recent censorship and site incidents by these Israeli lobby parasites here. Does this incident, this expose, come as a surprise to me? Of course not. After Obama's election, any discussion, threads about me or my case were also banned from the parasitic Zionist neoconistic mega establishment mini mouthpiece, meaning the cause, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't bother writing about it. With the reason so obvious, with the pattern so very clear, and with the involvement and developer participant agendas extremely translucent, why waste time to dwell upon it?
It took one article to get on this extension of partisan status quo's blacklist. While foaming at the mouth, they yelled, "How dare she criticize Obama? She should focus on Bush, Cheney, FBI, and
DOJ,
and leave the rest of the politics to our experts. Any real criticism and exposure of Obamacons made it to the top of their no-no list."
Same goes for other dangerous topics. Even though initially this forum started off on the back of rational and legitimate 9/11 critics, despite milking the attention on 9/11-related topics at the time, It very quickly changed course and started banning and censoring any and all topics relating to 9/11.
The real establishment is nonpartisan. It seeks power, control, and, of course, mega dollars. For them, real, independent, and rational ideas are dangerous. For them, the free exchange of ideas is extremely dangerous. For them, the possibility of the exchange of independent, rational ideas leading to real action is detrimental. So be realistic and ask yourself, what are they to do? Shouldn't they rein in any forums and channels with any potential of becoming a place for any rational, independent ideas that may lead to any real action? Right. So welcome the phony alternative news. Welcome to the little parasitic puppet forums. Welcome the existence of sites such as the Daily Cause. Need I say more?
That's from, you can go to, excuse me, to boilingfrogs.com, which is a civil evidence website, very good site. And she talks a whole lot about a whole lot of things. And
that's just to let you know that all some of these phony progressives.
Yeah. Israel's biggest protest in decades overtook worldwide. This is, I'm hoping I can get this one.
Overlooked worldwide.
Yeah, overlooked worldwide. There's about 130,000 protesters.
In Israel.
Let's go to this one.
Burying their heads in the sand over coverage of the biggest anti-government protest the country has seen in decades. Well, tens of thousands of people, fed up with deteriorating living standards, are staging demonstrations calling for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to stand down. But as Paul Sliger reports from Tel Aviv, protesters' voices are simply going unheard by the rest of the world.
Tens of thousands on the streets of Israel, angry, fed up, and protesting for change. But is anyone listening?
When it comes to Israel, a lot of the foreign media want to see more of an action movie, and this hasn't been very violent. It hasn't been violent at all. It's been very positive.
Well into week three, the largest demonstration in Israel in over a decade. And how did ABC, CBS, and NBC cover it? They didn't. A younger woman set up a tent while the editors of France 24, BBC, and Sky coughed up just a few meager seconds.
Perhaps it's not even that interesting to their editors back, you know, back in the studios. Okay, there's a protest. Well, what exactly is a protest? A social protest? Was it a revolution? It's not the same kind of story that they're used to, and it's not as big and dramatic as some of the bigger revolutions happening around the Middle East.
And Amir Mizrach isn't surprised by the worldwide lack of media interest. He's worked in the Israeli press for a decade, reporting for media both foreign and local.
There is a box that the international media has put Israel in, and that is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Also the Israeli-Lebanese and Syrian conflict. And anything that doesn't kind of fit into that is not the immediate type of news item, which is unfortunate.
This street has been dubbed Tahrir Corner by some of the people here. An optimism, perhaps, that they too can bring down a government in the way their neighbors in Tahrir Square, Cairo, did. But whereas the cameras there were rolling non-stop, here they're pretty absent.
That just makes Hannah Reyes and others angry. For 9 days, she's been camping here, furious that she can't make ends meet as a university student.
It makes me upset that when Egypt decided to stand up and say we've had enough, and when in Lebanon they decided to say we've had enough, the media was all over there. I haven't seen anyone from CNN or from Fox News or any other, you know, big news channel here, and it's really sad. We also deserve a chance to be heard out.
But according to independent media consultant Jeremy Rudin, the protesters need to be patient.
It hasn't really reached international proportions yet. It's not that the government has fallen. This is like an inside turmoil story. And that is a bit of a problem when you're looking from overseas, trying to figure out what to cover. It's not that, you know, the economy has collapsed.
But long before the economy collapses, protesters here might have to throw in the towel. Because, as demonstrators have learned around the world, without the international press and without the pressure of foreign governments, a protest can go only so far. Paula Sphere, RT, Tel Aviv.
Blogger Danny Schechter says that the reality of life in Israel often goes unnoticed because the country only attracts coverage for its role in conflict.
Many Americans think somehow the Israeli government is very popular. The leaders of Israel get a lot of attention in the American media. Israel is presented almost as a monolithic country when it's actually an extremely divided country. A massive protest of the kind we've seen in Israel about just the economic realities that people there are experiencing is something Americans have no understanding of because there's no context and no reporting. Israel is only reported in the context what's happening to people there and how this right-wing government in Israel is handling the economy is something that we never really hear about whatsoever. It's a very unstable situation. The economy there is very unstable as well. Well, you know, when you look at the Middle East, generally speaking, they talk only about the Arab countries. Only they have internal discord. You never hear about Israel's internal discord. And the fact that this uprising, essentially, is taking place in Israel, while at the same time there's one going on in Syria, there's one going on in Egypt, you know, shows that the same pressures are, you know, being experienced by Israeli people as well, which is inflation, economic pressure, food prices rising, all kinds of economic uncertainty.
Well, more news is coming from Israel, where the prime minister has announced he is ready to discuss Israeli borders with Palestinians. Well, Benjamin Netanyahu has agreed to negotiate a possible return to pre-1967 territory lines. Now, Israel has been occupying land in the West Bank where Palestinians hope to build their own state since the Six-Day War was over 14 years ago. Now, peace talks over borders have been stalled since last September due to construction of Jewish settlements in the area.
And that was from Russian TV, but the interesting thing there is that they're talking about possibly the 67 borders. Last month, that was out of the question.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be the internal struggle there. Must be putting a lot of pressure on them.
Well,
and that's good.
The Israeli people don't agree with what their government is doing.
Right. Now, before we go to, we have Larry Dorman coming up in about 4 or 5 minutes, and I want to get to him. But this article knocked me out when I read it. You didn't hear about this anymore.
No, you don't hear about
Ron Paul had to do. But it turned out that Ron Paul introduces a bill to cancel $1.6 trillion in debt held by Federal Reserve.
Representative Ron Paul on Monday introduced legislation that would lower the federal government debt by canceling the roughly $1.6 trillion in debt held by the Federal Reserve. Paul has argued for the last 2 weeks that the idea represents a quick way to make the growing financial crisis more manageable. Under his bill, H.R. 2768, the $1.6 trillion that the Treasury owes to the Federal Reserve would disappear. The Federal Reserve began buying Treasury bonds in earnest late last year as part of its effort to keep long-term interest rates down. But Paul has argued that the Fed purchases of Treasury debt represent a debt that the government owes to itself, and one that also leads to an unwanted and inflationary increase in the money supply. Good.
So there you go. We're so proud of this guy to do that.
And I wonder how many of those guys in Congress even understand what he has to say. If they really can figure out and understand, they need some help with their finance, understanding of finances.
Yeah, and that's why they put Ron Paul in charge of the finance committee, because he's the only guy who understands it. All right, but the Federal Reserve, Paul has also said that the Fed is allowing the federal government to continue a spending binge it otherwise would not be able to afford, and is forcing the Fed to print money to keep up. If the federal government could not cut spending and bring the budget back into balance, the Fed undoubtedly will be forced to simply monetize trillions of dollars in Treasury debt, which is nothing more than a stealth form of default. And Paul is highly
back in May.
Yeah, and Paul is highly critical of the debt ceiling agreement that the House approved Monday, and said that rather than require real cuts in spending, the bill mostly cuts planned spending levels in the future. According to the legislation, discretionary spending in 2012 would be just $7 billion less than in 2011, and in 2013 it would be $3 billion less than 2012. Good Lord. So anyway, no plan under serious consideration cut spending in the way you and I
think about it,
Paul wrote in a piece that appears on the Hill. Instead, the cuts being discussed are illusionary and not cuts from current amounts being spent, but cuts in projected spending increase.
And he wrote this on the Hill's Congress blog.
Right. So that's from Ron Paul. And check that out.
Now, of course, we never heard anything about the bill that he introduced.
No. That was introduced yesterday, by the way. All So, okay, we're going to go to, hang on one second here. I've got to call our guest. We've got Larry Dorn coming up in just a few minutes.
And Larry's going to talk about, he's the public affairs coordinator again for AFSCME Union, Council 4 here in Connecticut. And he's going to talk about the state of the state unions, and which he's actively involved in, and the national unions. And
that's the state of Connecticut, by the way.
Yes, that's what I said. I just mentioned that.
Oh, okay.
I said he's public affairs coordinator. You also talk about the national union and what's happening with that. You can give us some insight. I know that they're starting to work get the bill passed.
Hello.
Hey, Larry, how are you?
Good, how
are
you doing?
Hi, Larry. Hey,
yes.
Larry's on the
line. Hi, Larry. No,
how are you guys?
Oh, I'm fine. I was just telling the folks at home that you're working really hard to get the agreement with Malloy passed, and I was wondering when the unions are going to vote again on that.
Yeah, our AFSCME union will vote on August 15th and 16th.
Oh, okay.
We have several bargaining units, and they're doing their voting over those 2 days, and we'll be wrapped up on the 16th, and then I think and all the unions will be done on the 17th, so by the 18th we should know where we stand, and hopefully the second time around is a charm.
Now, you made some changes in how the voting will be passed, is that correct?
This is right. This is a revised agreement. Much of the language is the same, but we did get clarification that the healthcare component is in no way connected, tied to, driven by. We'll put state employees in the Sustinet package or legislation, I should say. And then there were some other clarifications regarding the pension trust fund, which is important. So I think it's an agreement that was improved for the better, and we're hopeful that this time around our members will vote to ratify it. Obviously, it didn't happen the first time around.
Yeah, you mentioned the last time we spoke with you that there was some outside interference the last time around, and that you had that you had brought that to court. What happened with that?
Well, we asked the Attorney General. We didn't bring it to court, Lila. We did ask the Attorney General to investigate what we felt was the misuse of the state email system,
mm-hmm.
and, as well as the fact that people outside state employment were essentially co-opting, using state employees to undermine the agreement. The Attorney General said that it could not be, and we specifically asked for an investigation of the far-right think tank, the Yankee Institute, which is funded indirectly from the Koch brothers, the notorious Koch brothers,
yeah.
funded Wisconsin, and funded directly by the Cato Institute. The Attorney General could not link the fake emails directly to the Yankee Institute, but we're disappointed, obviously, but the Attorney General's report clearly states that the state email system is archaic, porous, and susceptible to that kind of infiltration, and clearly people who were not state employees were triggering viral email changes that email charges that spread all kinds of misinformation. But we have moved on, and we are focused on trying to get this thing ratified the second time around.
I gotta ask you though, Larry.
Mm-hmm.
We've been reading we read a few articles right before you came on. One was about the FAA. They're anti, and the Republicans anti-union clauses that they're trying to. This is why they shut the FAA down,
right?
Recently, and I was kind of appalled to find out that isn't the FAA unionized? Aren't their workers unionized?
You have federal. You mean the actual agency itself?
Yeah.
Or the company that regulates. Yes, yes, absolutely.
Right. Well, you know what they're doing, which really was very odd. They have these inspectors and that are working on the FAA.
Yeah.
Right now they're working without getting paid. They're paying for their own airfare.
Right.
And everything else.
They often have to go to four or five airports
within 2 weeks. Yeah, and they're paying for their own hotel rooms and everything, hoping that they'll be reimbursed, but they're paying for it out of their own pockets without any salary, without anything at all, all right? And I don't understand anything that's happening there. If they're a union, why in hell is the union allowing them to do that?
It's a good question, and I don't... Yeah,
beyond
I don't.
Me,
I'm
sorry. Go ahead.
It's not a good situation. I don't know specifically if the inspectors are unionized or not. That's something I'd have to actually look into. That might be part of the problem. Is that they're not represented. But if they are, then obviously there's some big issues there, and it's. You know, another example of how alarming things are at some of these agencies.
Oh, yeah, and it just seems
regulate
like,
and protect us.
Yeah, I mean, they're caving in everywhere when it comes to unions. And the other status, the other sad thing was, what was the other article that we just read on?
I'm going to find that. I'm going to actually find out more about that and call
you
back
that one
or
over
email you. Yeah.
If you'd like. And it was from The Economist or something.
The other article we read is that with the loss of union members, there's a decline in jobs and a decline in pay.
Yeah, that was the Mother Jones article, I believe.
Yeah, it went from like 30% in the 70s of unionization to 8% now. Okay?
Pretty alarming.
It's frightening. It's
very
staggering.
Scary.
And then what's happening to the public worker segment is absolutely unbelievable.
We've had these, and that's why I appreciate what you're doing. We've had these discussions on your programs, and it's one of the most troubling economic trends we've seen. And whether you're unionized or not, the fact of the matter is that the decline in unionization, the decline in the number of workers who are unionized as a percentage of the overall workforce correlates exactly with a steep, steep decline in personal income and
that's exactly
earnings.
What that was showing with the graph and everything. It just was clobbered. I think what bothered me the most was when I was how it stated that something like there's been a 75% increase in the production.
Yep.
And productivity
of workers.
Of workers, and only a 25% increase in wage
compensation
and benefit compensation, and this is over the last since the 70s,
right, which is when you can track the decline of unions. A lot of things have happened, globalization, the horrible free trade deals. The growth of the franchise economy, some technological advances, but obviously one of the major contributing factors has just been the near total outsourcing of decent paying middle class supporting and creating jobs.
And the other thing, there was another part of that article was talking about this particular debt ceiling debate.
Yep.
And what happened?
And the recent
will cost 1.8 billion jobs by 2012. 1.8 billion. Okay.
Yeah.
Because of what they've done.
That agreement is not really good for the American people.
Not at all.
No, it's not. And it appears that a lot of people kind of may have caved in a little bit to let this happen. We don't have a spending problem. We have an unemployment problem in this country. So I'm really hard pressed to explain how the potential loss of millions upon millions of middle-class jobs is going to help this country. If someone can explain that to me, I'm all ears, but nobody, I think, can give me a rational explanation.
Well, my feeling was that Obama didn't show good leadership during this time, and what he really needed to do was sign an executive order to raise the ceiling and not accept any of these poor agreements that were put up by those Tea Party people.
Right. It's incredible how they really did just, you know, they it's like they heard the footsteps coming without even knowing if there was a real threat or not and just panicked.
That's right.
You know,
could have happened. He could have signed an executive order, raised the debt ceiling, and say, take me to court.
And, look, if the Republicans were in power, they are very good at acting autocratically. You know, from the start, Bush said, I have a mandate to govern, even when he only won, you know, by the slimmest of margins. And, you know, and when he defeated Kerry, it was the same thing. And, you know, and I give them credit. They were always disciplined, and they were always on message. And, unfortunately, you know, the Democrats don't seem to be as disciplined. They don't seem to be on message. And, you know, one thing you can say, in defense of Obama, you know, without a Democratic-controlled Congress, he's, you know, somewhat more isolated. And, I think there's a lot of fearful reaction going on. But, I agree with you, this isn't a time for timidity. And, you know, we seem to be getting a lot of that out of Washington.
Well, all he seems to be able to do is compromise the American people's values away and what they care about.
Mm-hmm.
That's his idea, you know, and his idea of compromise is the Republicans or a small segment of the Republican Party tells him what they want and he agrees to it. That's what he calls compromise.
Yeah, look, this is troubling. We had a stewards and local union president training for our state employees yesterday to go through the revised agreement and, you know, help our local union leaders and stewards explain the agreement and get yes votes. And we actually spent some time talking about the fact that the need for state employees to vote yes has grown even more urgent because of the so-called debt ceiling compromise, and I hate using that word. You know, we're looking down the barrel. All the states are looking down the barrel, as you say, of, you know, more cuts to programs, more cuts to in jobs, and this is going to be ugly, ugly, ugly. And, you know, I really shudder to think what kind of world we're sending on for the kids and for the grandchildren who really do.
I know it's very scary, isn't it, Larry? I mean, you've been working so hard this past 2 months, really. How are you doing?
You know, I'm hanging in there. It's obviously we were disappointed by the results, but we're back. We're plugging away. But these are difficult times, and, you know, it's not a Connecticut problem. It's a nation problem. It's a national problem, I should say. It's a global problem. But, you know, we're all hanging in. We are fighting the fight both at the state level. We're fighting in New Haven. You know, we have a tentative agreement that would put the brakes on privatizing school custodians. We're hopeful that we can get that ratified. We're doing a lot, you know, but the climate is absolutely horrendous in terms of the national debate and in terms of the debate about fair taxation and the debate about holding companies accountable. It's really, really quite frightening. You know, I do try to think globally, and my daughter and I were watching Current Network, you know, the network that Al Gore started.
Yeah.
And they had a show last night about, they did a documentary, a very good piece, an hour-long segment on the fact that the tobacco companies having, big tobacco having sort of been rebuffed here in this country, is marketing like mad in Indonesia. And there was a viral video of an Indonesian baby about 2 years old smoking. Kids smoke in Indonesia, and it's really a disturbing piece. And so I was talking to my daughter, who's 23, and, you know, saying this all goes hand in hand. you know, we strip away the good jobs here. We send them offshore to countries like Indonesia where we can exploit the workers. Is it any shock that the corporations are, you know, marketing and exploiting and causing a deterioration in the health of the people of these countries where they have them working as slaves? Any shock? Any surprise?
Oh, boy.
Well, you know what, Larry? I just wanted you to know, I just sent over an email. I just forwarded this Think Progress to you.
I'm going to look into that and write back to you because that.
I think you'll enjoy it. Look, and check out the links. They've got links on Twitter and stuff. But here's, you know. I was just going to tell you about, I don't know if you heard about this one or not, but Detroit's emergency manager cuts teachers' pay by 10%, ignoring union contract. And it says the employees accepted a $93 million wage concession, all right,
but
a
it
year
wasn't
and a half
enough.
Ago. But it wasn't enough for them. And then they ignored the whole thing and just cut them 10% right off the top just this week, all right, reducing an average wage to average reduction of $7,300 for every teacher. And then it says food service workers.
$7,300.
Yeah, $7,300, yeah. Food service workers and bus attendants, some will make less than $24,000 a year and will now be forced to go on public assistance to get by. Imagine that.
Oh,
I just cut everybody by 10%.
I can't.
Right,
the CEOs are, their pay is skyrocketing. The corporate profit levels are up. I mean, something is drastically, dreadfully wrong.
It's a totally.
And they wouldn't look at going back to the tax brackets that we had under Clinton for the very wealthy.
Right, which would be like a 2.5% increase, and we might actually do a good job of helping close the deficit that everybody seems to be so worried about.
If we just have these ridiculous wars and listen to Ron Paul about how to handle the federal deficit, we'd be in pretty good shape.
Ron Paul just put in a bill yesterday to cancel the Federal Reserve debt, okay, that we owe of $1.6 trillion, all right, and said just wipe that debt out, and it can be done because it's money that we owe to ourselves. But the other thing that's really interesting, here's another one article that came up. Joe Lieberman says U.S. should cut Social Security to pay for fighting the Islamist extremists. Can you imagine that?
No, I can't, but I'm not surprised either. I mean, this is the kind of narrow thinking that has helped get us into the mess. You know, it's Republicans and Democrats kowtowing to these imaginary enemies and these imaginary myths about government and about taxes and really ramming some bad ideas down the throats of working America.
Absolutely.
Totally alarming. Ron Paul fascinates me, and I think it's healthy that he's around trying to I think in many ways it's helpful for, you know, he's trying to hold Republicans accountable, which I think is a good thing.
The only thing that bothers me so much is the fact that he is a Republican. If he were an independent, he'd have I'd love him as a candidate, but because he's a Republican, you know, it just doesn't make sense. You know, and he really does not badmouth his own party.
No, he doesn't.
You know, he pretty much doesn't.
He stays away from that and
concentrates
on the areas that he thinks are important, believes that will.
No, although they badmouth him, so I think they're a little bit nervous about him.
Ignoring him as well, you know, but you know, I don't know. He'd be a great candidate if he wasn't a Republican.
So Larry, looking forward, is there going to be a big union meeting, or has there been a big union meeting this summer, or where you're all going to get together and decide how you're going to deal with the fact that unions are being attacked in a bigger way? Does the union leadership have a plan?
Yeah, interestingly, we've been meeting both with the Connecticut AFL-CIO and among ourselves, and certainly we're having those discussions. I mean, earlier this year we launched our own campaign for the middle class, and you know, we need to kind of get back into those basics about supporting and refortifying the American dream. And I think what's unfortunate is that everybody, unions across the country, are getting so absorbed in and perhaps sucked in by the demands and the pressures that the economic debate has exerted on our members that we've got to deal with all these kinds of concession agreements and other things that, while necessary, do distract us or do, you know, delay kind of sitting down and saying, what are we going to do to move forward for the working people of America? And, you know, that's a little bit troubling. We're having these kinds of needless debates about defending public employees and defending union workers when we should be really talking about how we're going to build a better, stronger, more vibrant middle class. And, you know, we're the only ones that seem who want to have that dialogue right now. A lot of our elected leadership doesn't, and we'll have to see if we can somehow change the terms of the debate. I mean, I will defend our members to the core. We were one of the unions that voted no under the old bylaws that have since been changed for the state union coalition. But, you know, it wasn't out of selfishness or whatever. I heard from countless state employees that they want to be part of the solution, but they're sick of being blamed. You know, and I think it's really important to be mindful of that point of view. Many state employees did not vote no because they're selfish or because they don't care. They voted no because they're sick and tired of every 2 years being blamed, scapegoated, and told to reach into their pockets when, in fact, you know, no sacrifice is being made by the people who can't afford to help close the deficit. So you know, I hope people are mindful of that, you know, this wasn't quite the act of selfishness that was portrayed in the media. There's a very real debate going on, you know, even within our own ranks about what you just mentioned, which is, you know, how are we going to move forward for all of the middle class when we're constantly being, you know, dragged down in these concession fights. It's what's happening in Detroit. It's what's happening in, you know, the entire state of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It's happening in Rhode Island. Central Falls, Rhode Island, just declared bankruptcy as a means of voiding all their collective bargaining agreements. This is bad
stuff.
Well,
was that the one that they fired all the teachers?
Exactly, they fired the teachers, and now they've declared bankruptcy, and again, they've vilified the sanitation workers and the park workers and the teachers who did not cause the problem. I think it's an interesting debate, and we're doing a lot of soul searching, Lila, in terms of that question you asked, because we need to move more aggressively to protect and expand the middle class, but at the same time, you know, we are busy being blamed for all of the economic ills that we really had nothing to do with, and you know, that makes it very hard.
Well, unions got to where they are because they took a hard line and they did strike.
Right.
And it also meant that if one union was in trouble, other unions supported them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if sanitation workers and hospital workers and teacher support staff all went out in the state of Connecticut because, say, there was a problem at Yale, which there always seems to be.
Yep, good point.
Because they don't treat their union employees very well. What if everybody went out on strike?
Right.
We don't do those sorts of things anymore.
Yeah, we need much
broader
civil action.
I think we do.
Yeah,
because if we're being attacked by the media, especially by Fox, so that unions have a really bad rap.
Yep. You would think that, you know, it's the retirement of the, you know, the fact that a school paraprofessional or a park and recreation worker or a school nurse or a sanitation worker, you know, or a plow driver, the fact that they have a retirement plan and a health care plan is somehow the cause of our woes. It's offensive and it's wrong. And, you know, we're the ones who have been demonized. And that's, you know, and that's why, you know, often you'll see some resistance from public workers about constantly being asked to make concessions, because at some point, you know, you don't have a whole lot to give up anymore. You know, Detroit's a good example. What you just mentioned, you know, the workers aren't making a lot to begin with, and now they're really being, asked to give up much more, to the point where many of them are going to go under the federal poverty level. So, you know, what are we doing here?
And why is it okay for management to not to throw out the contract, but it's not all right the other way around for a union to go out and strike? But nobody says anything when management says, "Well, we just can't do this anymore. We want, you know, you have to give up this and give up that."
Right.
I have just one thing I was going to tell you, and this might explain a lot of your questions. There's an article that said J.P. Morgan tells investors why middle-class Americans are screwed.
Yeah.
All right? And the quote, and the quote is this. In a recent report in a J.P. Morgan memo to their investors from Michael Symbolist, the chief investment officer, he says, U.S. labor compensation is now at a 50-year low relative to both company sales and U.S. GDP. Semmelis continues to explain why corporate profits are so strong while the rest of the working class are feeling the pinch. He quotes, "In reduction in wages and benefits explain the majority of the net improvement in margins. 75% of the increase in profit margins directly correlate with a reduction in workers' wages."
Wow. That says it all.
Yeah.
That,
that comes straight from the corporate mouth.
That's it. Yeah. And this guy goes on to say, why are your Republican friends aggravated? They aren't getting paid for their fair share of national GDP. And he's talking about the Tea Party and so on, and why the Tea Party's so out of their minds, you know, over the, and when it comes, when they're telling you, when he says J.P. Morgan's they're saying right there, you know.
And that's what's going on, is that workers' wages are plummeting. Their benefits are plummeting with those wages. Corporate profits are up. CEO pay is way up. This is just a wonderful time if you're a corporate titan. But it's not a wonderful time if you're a middle-class worker trying to make ends meet and send your kids to school or whatever.
Yeah, and you wonder how the tide can change or how we can make the tide change.
Yeah, and that's why I say I think that, quite frankly, we in the labor movement need to do a lot of soul-searching and a lot of strategizing, because so many of us are engaged, you know, as I've been, to you know, my own detriment in terms of trying to explain concession agreements and making sure the public understands what's going on. And, you know, we're getting so caught up in these constant attacks that to a certain extent, it's helping the corporate enemy and the super wealthy enemies, who really are the ones who want to keep us down.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sending this over to you too, Larry. So if you might want to quote that from in your.
That's what I'm thinking, because I want to use that actually. I want to use that with our own members and remind them of what's going on.
Yeah, that really says it all. That, and that's from their own mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from corporation. They
right,
tell
right.
us. They don't hide anything. They just say it right.
No, they don't. They don't. They're winning, and they're going to let you know it.
That's right, and how they're winning. And it's really upsetting, too, when you look around the country, when you see how the ordinary person is just being attacked and vilified, you know?
Yeah, and it, you know, and you have to, and again, it's why it's so important that you guys are doing what you're doing, because, you know, I think what certainly causes me to be concerned is how will people respond in the 2012 elections? Indeed, how will they respond just for their own municipal races coming up this fall? You know, we need to have people who champion the middle class serving on the local boards. You know, we need to have those people in the state legislature. We need to have people in Congress who are willing to fight. And, you know, my fear certainly is with the constant attacks and the erosion of unions, you know, are people feeling disenfranchised? And, you know, are they going to be sitting on the sidelines when people actually need to, you know, redouble the efforts in the upcoming elections? And it's going to be a lot to ask, but it's going to be interesting to watch.
Now, AFSCME, as a union, gave a huge amount of money and then supported Obama.
Mm-hmm. True.
What kind of are we going to support him again, do you think? Because he wants to run.
My guess would be yes, but I also would, you know, issue not so much a caveat as, a kind of a sense of what the debate will look like. The AFL-CIO is talking about trying to do things differently because we don't want to be seen as rubber stamping any kind of party or any platform that's been co-opted by all the Tea Party stuff that's going on and by all the corporate powers. So I think you're going to see an interesting debate in the labor movement regarding the endorsement process and how to hold candidates accountable, at least those candidates who have been supported by union members in the past and who have been less than stellar votes, whether it's in Congress or locally. So, you know, it's too early to say what will happen, but I think that given the onslaught that we've seen, given the attacks on collective bargaining, the attacks on workers' rights, this nationwide push, we certainly can't have, you know, it can't be business as usual for any of us when it comes to politics, when it comes to collective bargaining, representation at the table.
I got one more to send over to you. This is
good. I'm looking forward to getting all this stuff, actually.
You got, this one's city to firefighter and police retirees. Give up 50% of your pension or risk losing it all. All right?
Where is that?
Central Falls.
That's the Central Falls, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's what's going on now, is that, you know, local and state governments don't even have any compunction about reneging on what amounts to a legal contract. And that's really scary. And, you know, you don't see states telling corporations, we gave you a loan or we gave you a grant, you didn't create the jobs, we're taking the money back. You know, God forbid we ever hold the corporations accountable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think they should be, and that's where I think we need to begin. You know, they promise jobs for people. They can't pull up and move out of state in 5 years and say, gee, that's too bad, we're reneging, we had all our tax benefits, we're going to India.
Right, yeah. Right.
And
that's
little,
what's going on, you know,
yeah.
That's what's going on. I don't know if you read Jim Hightower.
Sometimes, yep.
Yeah, the guy from Texas, and he wrote a piece on his website about 10 days ago, the fact that Goldman Sachs has now set up this investment fund to help companies move jobs to Singapore. And Goldman Sachs, of course, is one of the bailout beneficiaries. So
yeah.
They've taken our tax dollars and are helping companies figure out ways to screw American workers and to exploit workers overseas. So, you know, this is all disgusting.
It really, really is, Larry. I mean, you have your work cut out for you, and I really admire all that you do, and I know you must have been working very, very hard these last few weeks, and I hope the this contract is accepted by the state union workers.
Me too. Me too.
Pretty good deal from what I had read.
You think
before.
So? It makes sense. It's going to save jobs. It's going to save services. It's going to, you know, keep people working, keep money circulating on Main Street. That's the most important thing we can do, and it keeps our union strength moving too. So, you know, hopefully it can perhaps get on before Labor Day, and we can, you know, we can talk about the Labor Day, and then hopefully I'll be able to report to you that we did have a positive outcome.
Well, good, and we'll look forward to having you
good.
On again.
Good, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks, Leo. They're already sent to you, so.
Thanks, I can't wait. I'm going to get online and read them, and you'll probably see some of them in the clips you get. So.
All right.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye.
And now our segment is with Woody, and we'll get his... we have Woody on, but something happened to his call, so we'll try him. Please call him.
See if we can get his, do you know his number?
Yeah, 631.
Four.
5.
So hang on one for
just
a second,
hang
folks.
On,
sorry for
folks.
This mess.
Right here.
Oh, he's back.
He's back. Okay. All right, folks, step into the ring with Woody.
Thank you. Fantastic. Technical difficulties week after week.
I know. I don't know what happened there. I had you on, and then you were off.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it works, Peter. So keep going.
Thank you. Before I get started, let me extend a special hello to two of my newest listeners up in Maine, Sherry and the lovely Linda. May your bubble tea always be bubbly. Okay, moving forward, watch your heads on the ropes as you step into the ring with Woody. Tonight's topics, NBA lockout, NFL comings and goings, and of course, baseball talk. All right, let's get down to it. A dour Commissioner David Stern suggested the Players Association is not bargaining in good faith and isn't serious about getting a deal done, putting a damper on yesterday's three-hour NBA labor meeting. Stern said he didn't feel too optimistic. He said this at his Midtown hotel following the first negotiating session since the NBA lockout began July 1st. I don't feel optimistic about the players' willingness to engage in a serious way from this session and many before. After the union was bargaining in good faith, Stern paused before saying with emphasis, I would say no. A grimacing Stern then bolted from the hotel. He did not smile once during his four-minute chat with the media, and his demeanor was even more downbeat than the last negotiating session, June 30th, when he announced the start of the lockout. Stern characterized the session as unproductive. We met for several hours, and I think it's fair to say we're at the same place we were 30 days ago. We agreed we'd be in touch to schedule additional meetings. Anything productive came out of the session? Say that 10 times fast. Stern said nothing. The NBA's claim is that 22 of the 30 teams were operating in the red. I think much like the NHL, these guys are not going to come to a deal, and I assume that we will not have an NBA season next year. I think it's going to be in lockout. I think the writing on the wall is that these players are already more than willing to go overseas and take less dollars, obviously, but at least still play the game they love, still stay in basketball shape, and screw the fans and screw the NBA. So we'll see what happens. But I think, as I said before, I don't believe there's going to be an NBA season next year, which will be too bad after, the playoffs, which are great to watch this year. They were a lot of fun, and it was an interesting – the finals was great. It was, good stuff to watch. It would be too bad if we lose our season. But I think that's probably what's going to happen. I would be very surprised if they get a deal done. I believe the average salary – in the NBA is $5 million. That's for the guy that doesn't even get into the game, period. Whereas in the NFL, the average salary is, I believe, $2 million. In the NFL, 80% of the players make $400,000, and then 20% make in the millions per year. So that's a big differential there. That's pretty big. So you can imagine what the differential is in the NBA. So, all right. Moving on, former Pro Bowler Randy Moss retires. He called it a career on Monday, prompting praise and skepticism among his peers and probably a little bit of relief among some defensive backs. The 13-year veteran wide receiver played for four teams, and he retired as one of the game's most talented but problematic forces. According to Hall of Famer Chris Carter and once a Moss teammate, he said Jerry Rice is in a class by himself, and then Randy Moss is the next. To me, Randy Moss is the next best receiver. I fail to agree with that statement, but whatever. That's Chris Carter. That's his boy. They played together from 98 to 2001, so you would expect him to say something good about him. His agent, Joe Siegel, announced Moss's decision only weeks after declaring the 34-year-old free agent was in excellent shape for the season. Randy has weighed his options and considered the offers and has decided to retire, Siegel told the AP. Former Vikings teammate Robert Smith said on ESPN that he thinks Moss will return. I'm pretty certain he can find a team if he wants to play, Carter said. But when you get to the point like Randy, you're only going to play under certain conditions. Now, I believe the Patriots offered him a deal, but it wasn't long-term enough. And then the Patriots turned around and signed Ocho Cinco, which I'll talk about in a little while. And then he wanted to go to the Jets, but the Jets signed Plaxico Burress, and I'll talk about that in a little while. So his, you know, choices were kind of winding down a little bit. I mean, Moss wants to win. The closest he came was in 2007. He caught an NFL record 23 touchdowns that year for the AFC champion Patriots. But as you know, the Patriots got beat by the New York football Giants in the Super Bowl that year, thank God. Moss's antics include squirting a water bottle at a referee in 2000, pretending to moon the crowd in 04, and there was also all kinds of other stuff that he pulled in the end zone, and all the times that he took off during plays where he just did nothing, and just, that was a real problem. He played for my Raiders for a while, and he makes it very difficult to even root for him in any manner whatsoever. He's just, I don't know, isn't he? He's really like a diva, like a lot of these receivers are from the word go. He's just very difficult to root for. You know, makes some great plays, but God, is he worth it? In the end, probably not. Okay, speaking of guys that are worth it or may not be worth it, fresh from prison orange or yellow or whatever, into J-E-T Jets green. Plaxico Burress signed a deal with the Jets since they didn't re-sign Brandon Edwards. Jets got a few phone calls from the likes of Santonio Holmes, a former teammate of his with the Pittsburgh Steelers, Rex Ryan, all kinds of guys trying to get him to become a Jet, and he signed with them. I'm sure he's been out of the game for almost 2 years, but I think it's a good signing for the Jets. I mean, all you got to do is put him down on the goal line and send the guy in a fade. And I mean, he's gonna, you know, he's gonna catch touchdowns. It's a good move for the Jets, and he'll be right at home with the rest of the rowdy dudes on the Jet team. So you know, you gotta like that move for the Jets. A couple of interesting moves. What I felt was out of character for the Patriots. They signed full-time diva Ocho Cinco and Haynesworth from the Redskins. As you know, I talked about Haynesworth last year. He wasn't up to performing for the Redskins' liking. They ran him through some drills, and he just like was real lazy, didn't do much. He was at odds with the coach from the word go, and just, you know, just nothing. Now, the guy still has some football left in him. I mean, he's a monster. You would think, now, frankly, I hate the Patriots, but the Patriots are good. They have very good talent evaluators there. You would think that when you're surrounded by other guys that have been winning and want to continue winning, they're not going to let some dude come in there and go half-ass. I just think that Haynesworth, they're going to make him play. He's going to play, or he's going to find himself in a very uncomfortable position in that locker room, you know, with guys that are going to want to win. So I think Haynesworth might have a huge season for the Patriots, and God, I just hope that he doesn't. But I think it's an excellent possibility. As far as Ocho Cinco goes, another surprising sign by the Pats. I just don't see them signing these guys that have whose characters are not stellar. You know what I mean? They're just not stellar, these guys. Ocho Cinco already heard it from the coach. Coach said he doesn't Facebook, he doesn't tweet, he doesn't do this, he doesn't do that, and maybe he should keep it down to a minimum. Ocho Cinco's response to that was, for many years he's done things his way, but now he wants to do things the winning way, the Patriots way, so he's going to tone things down. You know, we'll see how long that lasts. For Ocho Cinco's sake, I hope that, you know, that it goes the whole season. Otherwise, you know, he'll find himself not getting the ball. You know, they'll just play around him. You know, Belichick, it can be very unpleasant. And, you know, they just won't throw him the ball, and that'll be that. Okay, moving on to a little bit more defensive, you know, football stuff. OCU and Mora, the Giants defensive tackle or end or whatever you want to call him, has been battling with the organization for a while. He wants some more money, and he's kind of unpleased with some things that are going on. I'm going to read you a direct quote from him that he emailed. The question was, you know, are you still going to be a Giant? I hope there is a chance, but who knows? What really annoys me is the hypocrisy of people clamoring for my head for asking for a new deal or to be traded, saying I have 2 years left on my deal. These contracts only mean something to us. Where's Sean O'Hara? Where is Rich Subert? True inspirational football players. They were cut after being injured. They have years left on their deal. Why is Jacobs asked to take a pay cut? He has years left on his deal. The fact is, in the business we are in, if you get injured or they feel like you underperformed, they cut you without hesitation. But if you clearly outplay your contract and ask for something to be done, you're a bad guy and not a team player. It's ridiculous. How does a guy who's had one good year, no disrespect to Charles Johnson, sign a deal and make more than both me and Tuck combined? It's not right. Everyone in this business understands that is exactly what it is, business. And just like none of us get upset when our teammates are released due to business decisions, the teams also don't get upset when something like this happens. A little bit of sour grapes on his part, but boy, he kind of hit a home run on a lot of points. You got to give it to the guy. He's also a beast. If the Giants get rid of him, they're making a huge mistake. I would sign him, kiss his ass, and shut him up. Otherwise, you're in for a long season. And the Giants won't trade him because, you know, you don't want to trade him. And then you see the guy sacking other quarterbacks, possibly yours, when he comes to town. Best move here would be for the Giants to give him some money, shut him up, kiss his ass a little bit, make him feel important, and move on. Because they need him in that defense. You know, the guy's a beast. To just give him some money and, you know, let him turn their rage on the opposing quarterback. I would do that as quickly as possible. Okay. Moving on a little bit. I was watching a little bit of baseball last week, and I was watching – I caught this Angels-Detroit Tigers game, and some interesting stuff went on during the game. You got Maglio Ordonez. He hit the two-run homer off of Weaver. He took a real long time around the bases, saying he wasn't sure if the ball was fair. Okay, I'll kind of give you that. Weaver kind of got a little souped up, the pitcher for the Angels. He used his several choice words to let Mags, you know, he wasn't really appreciative of that. Then Carlos Gillian puts Detroit up with, you know, 3-0 with a seventh-inning homer, and he kind of admires his handiwork longer than an art history major might stand in front of the Mona Lisa. Tempers flare, benches are warned. Gillian took, by the way, 29 seconds to stroll around the bases. That's like an eternity. Weaver fired his next pitch near the head of Tigers catcher, Alex Avila, and is immediately ejected, which was fantastic. And this is great, all the while Verlander is throwing a no-hitter, which is just great. So there's like a lot of pressure going on. Then Angels shortstop Eric Bybar, he tries to break up Verlander's no-hitter with a bunt leading off in the eighth inning. Verlander is charged with an error on his wild throw. Had he thrown the ball correctly and not whipped it out of place, guy would have been out, and he wouldn't be crying about it afterwards. Ibar then elbows Verlander when scoring. The no-hitter is still intact. Verlander appears to threaten Ibar. A clean single by Izaturas breaks up the no-hit bid, and, you know, Detroit ends up winning the game, and there's all kinds of talk back and forth afterwards and everything. I thought it was really funny of Verlander to call it Bush League for the guy to bunt just to break up his no-hitter. Even his own manager contradicted him on that one. I'm not sure, but if my team's being no-hit by you, why would I would want to help you get a no-hitter against my team? Why? I just don't understand that. I'm supposed to help you. I'm supposed to take something out of my arsenal so you can get a no-hitter against my team. Are you freaking crazy? Verlander is just right out of his mind. Actually, out of his mind. I'm so glad he didn't get a no-hitter. Screw him. Anyway, let's move forward a little bit. I'm going to do a little Yankee talk. Interesting stuff going on with the Yankees right now. They put a couple guys on trade waivers, Burnett and Posada. Now, they've put A.J. Burnett, Rafael Soriano, and Jorge Posada on trade waivers. Now, that doesn't mean any of the trio will be dealt. However, they are eligible to be claimed by other clubs within 48 hours. If multiple clubs claim them, the team with the lower winning percentage is awarded the claim and can talk trade with the Yankees. The Yankees can pull the players back, but if they put them out a second time and they get claimed, the player goes to the team making that claim. That's how Jose Canseco became a Yankee in 2000, because the Yankees were trying to block him from going to the Red Sox. Now, Burnett is owed $49.5 million across the next three seasons, and Soriano a combined $25 million in 2012 and 2013. Any team claiming them runs the risk of the Yankees letting them go, although that is highly unlikely. Most teams do this in a large part, often it's to gauge interest of other clubs and the starting point for off-season deals. For example, last year I believe the White Sox put a claim in on Manny Ramirez, and then they made a deal with the Dodgers. There are three types of Shields on optional waivers. We'll just have to wait and see. The price tag on Burnett and Posada and Soriano is just so cost prohibitive that I would be shocked if anyone even sniffs around those guys to pick them up. I just don't see it happening. There's no way it's happening. What is happening, the Yankees have a little dilemma right now. They're working on a six-man pitching rotation, and here's the deal. If Hughes pitches good tonight, then, you know, he might stick around. And if Nova pitches good, well, then, you know, they're going to have a hard decision to make. But one of them won't pitch good. If Hughes pitches good and Nova pitches good, I don't know. Frankly, I would keep Nova in the starting rotation, and I would send Hughes to the bullpen. It'll get his velocity up even more. And he's used to being in the bullpen, and it's just one more guy in the bullpen that can probably perform in the clutch. I'd take him out of the rotation. That's just me. I really hope Nova pitches a stellar game against the White Sox and Hughes only pitches an okay game. I would rather have Nova up. Nova's, I think he has like 10 wins. The guy's young. I like that. Hughes is young too, don't get me wrong. It's not like Hughes is over the hill or anything. But right now, my personal opinion, I think it would be best for the team to have Hughes in the bullpen and Nova as starter. That's just my opinion. We'll certainly have to wait and see. But it's definitely, you know, something's going to be done. They're not running a six-man rotation. That's not going to happen. Girardi just did it so he could give Garcia and Colon an extra day here or there, and it's not going to continue. They're going to make the decision this week. So we'll just have to wait and see. Okay. That's it for this week. Shout out to all my woodheads out there, Ron, Mark, Leo, Dino, Troy, everyone at the Northeast Athletic Club, Money Mike, Sherry and Linda up in Maine. That's it for this week. Enjoy some of the sun, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you, Woody. Report, and we also thank our guest Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME, who keeps us up to date on union issues, and we know how hard he's been working, and I hope they have great success with passing this agreement with Governor Malloy for union workers, state union workers. So
we hope everything works out, but in the meantime, oh, and you might want to check out the Economist, the Economy, that's the name of the blog that said some fascinating news on that particular blog. You can go to that. You just found in the Economy, probably .com, didn't say, but it's got its own server, I guess.
If not, .org.
.org.
Try either one, it'll come up.
The Economy,
yeah. You get some interesting things going on with the Economy.
Yeah.
And I think we'll have a little music break.
Yeah, we're going to go away for a quick music break, and we'll be right back after this. So we'll do some health and environmental reports. We've got quite a few interesting articles for you there. Here we go. Be right back.
Backyard rain gauge. Aluminum. 1,010 micrograms per liter of aluminum.
Mm-hmm.
And here's barium, 8 micrograms per liter of barium. And this is from the labs up in Redding, California. This is a certified government report. And here's what normal is. I asked them what would be normal.
0.5
would be normal
for
aluminum. And the maximum allowed in drinking water, they said 50 micrograms per liter, and government action required at 1,000. Well, we're over 1,000.
We're so far off the scales for toxicity in aluminum that it appears to be affecting the flora greatly. Our grass is about a third its height that it was only a few years ago. A 35-year forestry biologist has done 50 pH tests, the rain. Across the board, every single test was 10 times or more alkaline than it should be. Four times its historical conductivity. more atmospheric conductivity would logically mean more light. It strikes that we had that day, I spoke to dozens of 30, 40-year veteran firefighters, and they've never seen anything like it. Atmospherically, they've never seen anything like it. And our skies were literally covered with aircraft trails the day that happened. But if you have a more conductive atmosphere, you're going to get more lightning.
Whether people believe in chemtrails or not, the geoengineering should be scary enough. And when people learn about geoengineering, chemtrails will then become apparent because they're the same.
This is from a snow surface at Mount Shasta.
Mm-hmm.
61,100 micrograms per liter of aluminum. This is just ordinary snow water. Mm-hmm. And people are drinking this stuff when they're hiking on the mountains. And remember, government action is required at 1,000. This is 61 times over the government limit, and our hikers are drinking this poisonous water on Mount Shasta Mountain itself. Strontium, 383. Barium strontium will take away from your bone structure, make for weak bone structure. The aluminum, though, that's scary. You know, what is it? Alzheimer's, autism, gosh knows what that's doing.
A number of other things, neurological. We speak of these tests that contain massive amounts of heavy metals. Often, the first response from people is, well, they're migrating from China. The California Air Quality Resources Board did a study on the aerosols from China, and metals were not amongst those aerosols. In the geoengineering patents, specifically describe a polymer fiber to keep those metallic particles aloft a little bit longer. So, again, if you have one of the most stringent air quality boards on the planet stating that these aerosols are not migrating from there, they weren't there 5 years ago, they're there in lethal quantities now, where are they coming from? Is that where they're coming from? You know, these aircraft you see laying these trails down? Again, all I can say for sure is that the metals we're seeing match the patents exactly, and the patents match what we see above us exactly, in the scope of creating artificial clouds. So we can only conclude this is the source of these metals.
The 1990 patent by used aircraft is for cooling the planet by using clouds containing aluminum and dispersed through air.
Maybe 6.8 if you look at the darkest little portions in there. But this is black oak leaf. This is black oak acorn. This should be very acid, and I'm getting 10 times higher than expected.
Oops. Okay. So.
Something happened there.
Okay. Anyway, so much for that.
So about half of that anyway.
No, all of it.
Oh, that was all of it?
A few minutes left. 1 minute left. NATO destroys Libya's 30 billion. No, that's not the one I wanted to create. There's one more health issue, one here that I have. This was really fascinating to me. This is justice, baby, justice. Tragic justice. The TSA reports agents developing cancer from naked body scanners.
Oh, isn't that awful?
Yeah. In a new twist to the TSA saga, which we can only say we told you so, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, or EPIC, has obtained documents through the Freedom of Information Act that reveal that TSA employees are reporting cancer clusters among their own employees who work near radiation body scanners. At the same time, the Department of Homeland Security refuses to issue dosimeters to TSA employees because obviously those dosimeters would indicate alarming levels of radiation exposure. So it's better to keep everyone ignorant and keep irradiating all the TSA employees and hope nobody notices, apparently. The TSA employees are getting themselves cancer by irradiating innocent travelers is perhaps the most striking bit of tragic justice we've yet seen in this entire fiasco. The TSA agents commit felony crimes every single day against innocent travelers, molesting them, illegally detaining them, and humiliating them as part of the security screening procedure.
They're also irradiating them with the naked body scanners, as they all know Janet Napolitano openly lied about. As a side effect of that irradiation effort, TSA employees are also irradiating themselves. Cancer, not surprisingly, will not be far behind. By the way, the best and most timely reporting on this subject is currently coming from Paul Joseph Watson at PrisonPlanet.com, who, together with Alex Jones leading the protest, has been hammering both the TSA and Texas legislature over these criminal pat-downs. In an age where nearly all mainstream journalism is little more than a comic shilling for big government, it's refreshing to know that people like Watson are still pursuing the role of honest journalism that questions government lies. But the Napolitano lied about the safety of the body scanners.
Why are the body scanners causing cancer clusters among TSA employees? As we reported yesterday, Janet Napolitano lied about the safety of the devices, claiming that NIST had affirmed the safety of them. NIST fired back an email that specifically explained that NIST doesn't test the safety of products at all, ever. Therefore, all the claims that these devices were tested and confirmed as safe was a complete BS from Napolitano. Just an outright lie, not a shred of truth to be found. You see, when government has abandoned the truth as a matter of policy, it can only resort to lies to further its agenda. The truth no longer has any place in the U.S. government, where criminals and thugs simply make up whatever lies they want, then pass them off as truth to the press, which dutifully reports all the government lies as truths. This is precisely the case with the TSA and these naked body scanners. It's also the situation with the economy, the unemployment rate, and the national debt. If you follow economic news, the American empire has become what the Roman empire was right before its fall, a tragic cabal of professional thieves and liars who run the government and steal from the people.
TSA employees... TSA employees fry their own genitals with radiation. Now, even though the NIST did not test the safety of these machines, it did warn airport screeners to avoid standing next to them, because the machines clearly emitted doses of radiation that could mutate DNA and cause cancer. The bulk of TSA employees who we've already established are among the most intellectually challenged individuals, which are still somehow employable, don't seem to care that they're getting fried with radiation every day on the job. In fact, many TSA employees don't even understand the laws of physics, as has been demonstrated over and over when they tell travelers truly idiotic things like, there's no radiation from these machines. True story. This is what one of our contributing writers was told by a TSA agent in Denver.
Gee, how do they think the machines work? Do they think they're magic? Who needs radiation when you can just use magic to see your people? The one notable upshot from all this is the realization that TSA agents might experience so much DNA damage from standing next to those machines that they will be rendered completely infertile and therefore have no ability to reproduce. This, the scientists say, is called natural selection. Those best adapted to surviving will pass on their genes to the next generation, while those who fail to protect the integrity of their own DNA get removed from the human gene pool. I can't think of a more appropriate example of natural selection in action.
Darwinian
TSA agents as a mid-morning snack, it seems. So maybe those radiation machines do have a purpose after all. All kidding aside, there's kind of poetic justice and the idea that these agents who terrorize innocents will one day find themselves on the receiving end of a chemotherapy drip. It's not that we wish suffering upon anyone, but this is suffering they have brought upon themselves. At what point, I wonder, will the cancer-stricken TSA employees finally figure out that the government is lying to them, too? It is a realization shared by many veterans who sign up for military service with all sorts of patriotic enthusiasm, and then one day realize the government has stolen their health benefits and abandoned their needs. Such is the result of naive faith in government. They couldn't care less about the people it claims to serve. Well, heck, I'm not even sure the government continues that serving the people cover story anymore. Now the government openly complains claims to be the supreme power over the servant people.
Yeah. And if you want to learn more at EPIC, read up on the Freedom of Information Act, cover-ups, the lies, and more of the EPIC website. Right? And there was one more TSA article I had tonight that I thought was really interesting because a woman, Nashville woman, arrested for refusing to let TSA agents molest their daughter.
For a while.
It's been around a little while, but I wanted to read it just since we were on TSA. When flying commercially, it's literally the U.S. Transportation Security Agency's administration's way of, or the highway. And a woman from the Nashville, Tennessee area recently learned that this is the hard way when she faced arrest after refusing to allow TSA agents at Nashville International Airport to molest her daughter with an enhanced pat-down. Reports say that after 41-year-old Andrea Fornelli Abbott told agents that she did not want her daughter to be touched inappropriately or have her crotch grabbed, police arrested her for disorderly conduct and hauled her to jail. She told them in a very stern voice, with quite a firm attitude, that they were not going through that x-ray.
Said Sabina Burge, an NIA security officer, concerning the incident. Burge apparently
Burge apparently also proceeded to rehash the line that naked body scanners are 10,000 times safer than cell phones, which is false. But Abbott still refused, emphasizing that she did not want TSA employees to see her and her daughter's naked bodies, much less be allowed to grope them. Now, reports do not indicate the age of Abbott's daughter, but most likely she was very young. She may have been even been under the age of 6, which means that the girl is not even eligible for the enhanced pat-down, at least according to the statements made by TSA Administrator John Pistoli last November. And actually, according to the U.S. Constitution, neither Abbott nor her daughter, nor any other air traveler for that matter, could have to be poked and prodded as part of the TSA enhancement security protocols, as this type of unreasonable search and invasion of privacy contradicts the Fourth Amendment. And regardless of whether or not Abbott threw a fit in the airport, which according to reports is how the situation went down, the woman's outrage is validated in light of the heinous reality of modern airport security. Travelers have two choices, a naked body scanner or the enhanced pat-down, and neither one is truly justified as a necessary or even legal security measure. Contrary to TSA claims, the naked body scanner at many U.S. airports are not safe, and the TSA is basically lying to the public about it and covering up all evidence that contradicts these false claims. And enhanced pat-downs, no matter how much rhetoric is used to dress them up, are nothing more than unwarranted sexual assaults that provided no added security benefits. And however, instead of just deciding not to fly at all, which is what some have suggested as a solution to this TSA problem, maybe it's time to actually disband the TSA and restore the American their Fourth Amendment rights to protection against unwarranted searches.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, taking naked images of innocent travelers and feeling up their private parts is a clear violation of this amendment, and it must be stopped. And that's from Natural News. Totally agree with him on that. There was one other one I wanted to read here. Let's see if I have another health issue one I thought. Oh, yeah. Hungary destroys illegal GM cornfields, plans to make distributing GMOs seed a felony. Want to read that?
I didn't see that one. GMO ban. Early in the week, it was announced that every crop field in Hungary that was known to contain genetically modified corn has been plowed under and destroyed, according to reports. GMO seeds are illegal in Hungary, and authorities have been working hard to ensure that no illegal planting or sale of GMO seeds takes place in the nation. Hungary's Deputy State Secretary of Ministry of Rural Development, Lajos Wagner, announced that upon the recent discovery of roughly 1,000 acres of illegal GM corn, all of these Franken crops was systematically destroyed. He also claimed that none of the pollen from the crops has spread and that the government will continue to monitor seed distribution and crop planting to ensure that no more GMOs are planted. A new Hungarian law enacted back in March stipulates that before any new seeds are introduced into the market, they must first undergo checks to make sure they are free of GMOs. Seed traders are also required to personally verify that all the products are free of GMO before distributing them, especially due to the fact that GMO seeds from Monsanto and Pioneer, two large biotech companies, have been found unintentionally intermixed with natural seeds. Unfortunately, for many unwilling Hungarian farmers, the discovery of unknown GMOs in their fields came at a time when it was too late to replant new crops in time for this year's harvest, and any potential compensation paid by Monsanto or Pioneer as a result of the damage will likely go to the creditors of the seed company that provided them, which is now under liquidation. It was announced shortly, just days after these events, that the Hungarian government plans to make distributing GMO seeds a felony, since as many as 6,200 acres of cropland may have already been contaminated by the unintentional or careless planting of GMO seeds. Authorities are cracking down as best they know how to keep Hungary GMO-free.
There we go. Why can't we do that?
Yeah.
Why do they allow, you know, all these European countries, a small country like Hungary, all right, is saying, screw you. Britain saying, screw you. France, Germany, everybody saying, screw Monsanto and GMO seeds. And yet the United States, Christ, we make Monsanto lobbyists our agricultural secretary.
Yeah.
I mean, who in the hell is kidding who? I mean, what a...
Because Obama hides in his office.
Yeah, fuck Obama.
Obama,
you rotten hell, you miserable prick. Right?
What he's inflicted on the American people is
just
horrible.
Just unbelievable. I mean, Bush was bad. Bush was the worst possible, but Obama...
He carried right on.
I think he's even worse. At least Bush didn't have a eugenicist as a science czar.
Yeah.
All right? Good God.
Got a good point there, Leo.
Yeah, and he didn't have a Monsanto lobbyist as an agricultural secretary, so I don't know. Jeez, that's just unbelievable. And we got a few more minutes, but there's something happening. This isn't health related, but it's really quite shocking. That, of course, wasn't mentioned in the press.
Oh, naturally not.
Yeah, I had to find it at Pack Alert Press. In order to find it, yeah. U.S. order to shut down millions of Christian websites shocks the world.
A shocking report authored by the Office of Russia's top religious leaders, Patriotic Kirill One, states that this past week the United States ordered over...
This was released on July 11th, too, and this is the first I've heard of it, so...
Ordered over 10 million Christian websites destroyed that they claimed were a threat to the national security, and that the American internet giant Google quickly responded by making them all disappear. According to this report, Google first came under assault from the U.S. government in June when the FTC announced that they had launched an investigation into the company, a move defended against by top Google executive Amit Singhal, who, aside from claiming the attacks against them were baseless, said, "At Google, we've always focused on putting the users first." After weeks of unrelenting pressure upon them, however, this past week, Google, which had refused to answer the baseless charges against them, caved to the U.S. government and announced that their chairman, Eric Schmidt, who had previously said the charges against them were nonsense, agreed to testify before a U.S. Senate committee under threat of subpoena. On the very same day that Google caved into these U.S. government demands, this report continues, they then announced that they had blacklisted and banned over 11 million websites that had been registered for free through the COCC subdomain the world over, giving as its reason for this largest in history removal of private websites. Google asserted that it had the right to pull a plug. Sites, if they see a very large fraction of sites on a specific free host, be spammy or low quality. So they pulled the plug because They said
well,
they
COCC
were...
COCC is the Internet Country Code top-level domain. CCTLD, or for COCOs, Keeling Islands, in Australian territory, is administered by VeriSign through a subsidiary company, ENIC, which promotes it for an international registration as the next .com. CC was originally assigned in October 1997 to ENIC Corporation of Seattle, WA by the IANA. Most important to note about this .cc domain, this report points out, is it's being preferred by churches and Christian organizations around the world as CC, capital CC. Also happens to be an abbreviation for Christian church or Catholic church, especially in Islamic nations where due to strict laws against Christianity, these free CO.cc websites were the only way those belonging to this faith were able to communicate with each other. In this Patriarch Krill, I report as to the true reason for the U.S. ordered government shutdown of millions of Christian websites in Islamic nations, it states, is the fundamental shift undertaken by Obama regime to support radical Muslim elements instead of the once secular Arab leaders it once did. And the most crucial U.S. turnaround in this regard happened this week, and as we can read, in part, as reported by the front page magazine New Science, the Obama administration is set to begin formal contacts with the Muslim Brotherhood, a group dedicated in its own words to eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house. This news came in a Reuters report Wednesday, quoting a senior U.S. official who spoke on condition of anonymity. Why this official felt it necessary to speak on condition of anonymity is a mystery, given the fact that Barack Obama has never made a secret of his solicitude for the Muslim Brotherhood, even though the Brotherhood was still outlawed in Egypt at that time. He made a point of inviting leaders of the group to attend his speech to the Islamic world in Cairo on June 4, 2009. And not only that, Obama included the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood linked group that had been named an unindicted co-conspirator in a Hamas terror funding case, along with the clerics giving a prayer during his inauguration ceremonies. Ingrid Mattson, then president of the Islamic Society of North America, offered this prayer at the National Cathedral on Obama's inauguration day, despite the fact that ISNA has admitted its ties to the Brotherhood. In fact, so overwhelming is the evidence of ISNA's involvement with the Brotherhood and Hamas that the previous summer, federal prosecutors had rejected a request from ISNA to remove its unindicted co-conspirator status. Obama even sent his senior advisor, Valerie Jarrett, to be the keynote speaker at ISNA's national convention.
It's kind of a long article.
Yeah. But anyway, the gravest danger posed by the U.S. ordered destruction of these millions of Christian websites, this report continues, involves the estimated 20 million Coptic Christians now living in Egypt who, should the Muslim Brotherhood gain control, would face the removal from their homes of all their children so they could be educated in Islamic schools as converts to the Muslim faith.
U.S. author Brad O'Leary learned in his book, America's War on Christianity, warns that no one should be surprised about these things, as many U.S. regimes, including Obama, have waged a decade-long war against this faith in their attempt to eradicate it from all forms of public expression, even to outlawing school children from even mentioning the word God, Bible, or Jesus Christ under threat of imprisonment. Even worse, shocking news is now coming from the United States that the Obama regime has ordered that the words God bless and Jesus Christ cannot be used even when burying the military dead. And as we can read in part, as reported by the Christian Post News Service, Texas Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison is calling for an investigation into the actions of the Houston National Cemetery director, who told pastors and veteran groups to stop using words like God bless and Jesus Christ during funeral services. Several veterans groups and pastors in the Houston area filed a religious discrimination lawsuit this week, charging that the cemetery's director, Arlene Ocasio, was censoring prayers and certain religious terms at funerals for veterans.
The most appalling of all these things is the vast majority of American people allowing their once cherished Christian values of home, family, and morality to be continued to be stripped away from them with nary a protest, as if they had completely forgotten that their religion would have never survived without the countless millions who martyred their lives, including Christ, and who so their faith could survive. And to the horrific future lying in store for Christians living in America today should come as no surprise either, as prior to this election, as President Obama stated in his response to them, it's not surprising then they get bitter, they cling to guns or religion and antipathy, this is Obama's quote, to people who aren't like them or anti-immigrant sentiment or anti-trade sentiment as a way to explain their frustrations.
Forgotten by Obama is that those Americans who cling to their guns and religion are the exact people that made the founders of the United States create the nation for, and though they have survived much since their founding, their silence today as a nation is allowed to be destroyed shows how truly weak they have become. And in that weakness lie the seeds of their own destruction, but which they are too ignorant of history to even see as their total destruction looms ever closer. That's really scary.
Isn't that frightening?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they're losing their own religion, and they don't even know it.
And we're right to the end of our show.
Yeah.
It's 10 o'clock, and we want to thank you for being with us tonight. And we want to thank our special guest, Larry Dorman, public affairs communicator, public affairs coordinator for Ask Me Union in New Britain, Connecticut, and also Woody for his segment In the Ring. And we look forward to talking to you again tomorrow.
Yeah.
And same place, same time.
Same place, same time.
And good night, folks. Enjoy the rest of your evening.
Good night, folks.